Support for this public radio podcast comes from Mellon Financial Corporation, helping financially successful individuals and families protect and maximize their assets through the practice of wealth management. Mellon.com. And by A.G. Edwards, caring for nest eggs for more than 120 years with a commitment to provide objective financial advice. Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, dedicated to a prudent approach to investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Don't look now, but the White House has discovered the joys of market regulation. After a summer of tainted food and toxic toys, the president announced new rules for imports today. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Reuters, the world's news and information source, working to make a difference every day. Before it's news, it's Reuters. And by Vanguard, offering 529 plans for those thinking about saving for college at vanguard.com/529.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Great to have you here on this Tuesday. It's the 6th of November. We spent some time last week on the program talking about the Consumer Product Safety Commission and how, despite Congress's best efforts, the commission didn't want any more money. No more authority to order recalls, thank you. Speculation was that the interim head of that agency was acting on White House orders. But today those orders changed for the CPSC, the Food and Drug Administration, and a half a dozen other offices that are supposed to keep an eye on what comes into this country. From New York, Marketplace's Jill Barshay reports.
$2 trillion of imports come into the U.S. each year. Government inspectors can't open up every box at the port to catch the bad apples. The Bush administration wants to send more inspectors overseas, fine violators more heavily, and give the Food and Drug Administration the power to recall bad products. Chris Waldrop is a director at the Consumer Federation of America. He says the FDA currently relies on industry cooperation.
It's a voluntary process, and they have to negotiate with the companies that are implicated in an outbreak or some sort of event like that.
Even industry is backing the proposed regulations. Scott Openshaw of the Grocery Manufacturers Association says the increase in food scares over the past 18 months calls for a new approach.
Because consumers must be able to trust the brands they buy, which we manufacture and provide to them, and they must be able to trust the foods that they eat.
New regulations on their own won't be enough, CFA's Waldrop says. He says the government will have to hire people to do the new inspections or impose the new penalties, and that won't come cheap.
You know, it's great to give these agencies more authority and give them, you know, greater responsibility, but they need the funding to be able to do it. FDA has been significantly underfunded over the past 5 to 7 years, and if they're going to really do their job, they need to have the resources.
Most of the big recommendations require congressional legislation. Congress is working on its own fix. With the Bush administration on board, the chances are higher something will get passed. I'm Jill Barshay from Marketplace.
As it happens, Nancy Nord, the head of the Consumer Product Safety Commission, was on Capitol Hill today for a hearing. Members of the House Energy and Commerce Committee wanted to chat with her about her having accepted some free trips from companies with issues before the commission. Nord took the opportunity to say no, she wasn't going to step down. Last week, House Speaker Nancy Pelosi and some others called on Nord to resign. The stock market managed some respectable gains today. Really, though, so what? Far be it for us to suggest that you ignore what Wall Street thinks, but maybe it's more significant to observe that the dollar slumped to its lowest level ever against the euro today, and that gold is more valuable now than it's been in almost 28 years, and that oil soared to a new record today, above $97 a barrel, and that Indy Mac, one of this country's biggest independent mortgage lenders, posted a quarterly loss way bigger than anybody expected. And, finally, that some people who ought to know are starting to voice their concerns publicly. Yeah, I'm just saying. Here's Marketplace's Bob Moon.
This isn't the same old gloomy story. It's a brand new story on how things keep getting worse. More and more investors are dumping their dollars for other currencies and putting their money into the safe havens of precious metals and bonds. Greg Salvaggio is a senior currency trader at Tempus Consulting. He sums up a growing belief the worst news may be yet to come.
The large U.S. banking players might have significantly larger exposures to subprime underperforming assets than they've let on.
Indeed, Citigroup's admission of even bigger subprime losses was followed today by IndyMac's worse-than-expected results, and Goldman Sachs was forced again to deny persistent rumors it may need to write down big mortgage-related losses. Ron Gudis of the Equitex Brokerage Group says it's not as simple as just waiting for another shoe to drop.
There are so many shoes that are going to drop here. I think Imelda Marcos' closet is going to be dropping at some point.
There were similar bleak warnings from influential financial leaders. Former Federal Reserve Chief Alan Greenspan said the housing debacle is a major risk to the U.S. economy. And Britain's top central banker Mervyn King told the BBC there's more bad news to come.
I think that most people expect that we have several more months to get through before the banks have revealed all the losses that have occurred, taken measures to finance the obligations that result from that.
Wall Street took heart in the prospect that all this might force yet another interest rate cut by the Federal Reserve, but that might just reflect how bad things have gotten. Just yesterday, the CEOs of several big Wall Street firms voiced worries about a recession during a conference hosted by Reuters. One CEO who was asked where the economy is headed in the next year or so said simply, "In the toilet." In Los Angeles, I'm Bob Moon for Marketplace.
Bill Clinton's going to be in Chicago tomorrow. He'll be up on a podium with Mayor Richard Daley to announce a big Windy City climate initiative. It'll use private funding to improve energy efficiency in buildings like the Sears Tower. The announcement is part of a plan to make Chicago a national leader in reducing greenhouse gas emissions. Only problem is, Chicago's already got a lot of competition. From the Marketplace Sustainability Desk, Sam Eaton reports.
It's getting harder for cities to make a splash with bold climate change initiatives. More than 700 of them have already pledged to reduce emissions 7% below 1990 levels by 2012. It's a symbolic gesture of support for the Kyoto Protocol, which the U.S. government refused to sign, and an increasingly modest gesture as cities like New York aim even higher. New York Mayor Michael Bloomberg has called for a 30% reduction in greenhouse gases by 2030. Not to be outdone, Chicago will reportedly announce a plan later this year to reduce its emissions 80% by 2050. Adele Simmons co-chairs Chicago's Climate Change Task Force. She says the competition between cities is real because it translates into jobs.
We think people like to live and work in a city that is sustainable and that is known to be an environmental leader.
Simmons says tomorrow's announcement in Chicago will lay out specific tools for reaching that 2050 goal. And those specifics are exactly what's needed, says University of Michigan public policy professor Barry Rabe.
We see in many states and certainly in many cities the effort to sort of reach out further and set that bar higher. But translating that into real numbers in real time remains to be seen.
One problem is mayors come and go. Another, Rabe says, is that only a few of the 700-plus cities that have signed the Kyoto Protocol have any chance of meeting the treaty's modest goal. That's mostly due to the fact that cities have little regulatory authority compared to states and the federal government. I'm Sam Eaton for Marketplace.
The options futures markets can be a tricky thing to figure out, but here's something that cuts right to the heart of it. With oil trading near $100 a barrel, traders aren't taking any chances. The Financial Times reports today there are futures contracts out there at $250 a barrel. That is, some guys basically buying the right to buy oil at that price on the assumption it's actually going to go even higher. There were some momentary stumbles on Wall Street today about the actual price of oil and some other things, too. But investors finished strong nonetheless. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. You heard Bob Moon just a couple of minutes ago. Recession's in the air more every day now, which would be bad news for just about everybody, from business owners to mortgage holders. But commentator Moira Mannion says those who don't have much don't have much to lose.
I've witnessed recessions kill off businesses large and small. I've seen recessions cost people their jobs. I smell a new recession in the offing. Trust me, I know the scent. And I'm not the least bit concerned. I have no debt. No credit cards, no mortgage, no car, no cell phone. I don't owe student loans. I have no financial obligations at all, beyond wishing to pay back friends who gave me money to pay my rent. This is because I'm poor. After taxes, I net $1,200 a month, but my monthly expenses are only $920. As long as I live frugally and nothing goes wrong, I can get by. If a recession hits and the store I work for goes out of business, I can easily get another minimum wage job in this servant economy. Since I have no debt to worry about, I can survive with an even lousier job. No, the people who need to worry are the people I see every day. Customers with 10 credit cards that are all maxed out. People with 2 cars, 2 kids, a mortgage, and no savings. The fresh out of college guy who bought a $190,000 condo while owing $40,000 in student loans and who still hasn't found his dream job. How are they going to weather the inevitable recession storm if they lose their jobs? Where will they go for help when public services have been cut? Here are some radical suggestions. Cut up the credit cards. Give up the $4 coffee. Take the bus. Learn to do without. So bring on the recession. I'll survive. Will you?
Moira Mannion works retail at the airport in Minneapolis-St. Paul. Drop us a line with your recession worries or your comments about something you hear on the show. Our website is marketplace.org. Click on that link that says contact. Members of the House Financial Services Committee spent their day considering the evils of predatory lending. Chairman Barney Frank has promised mortgage reform by the end of the session later this month. Today, committee members and the rest of us got a glimpse of exactly how hard it can be to avoid foreclosure sometimes. University of Iowa professor Catherine Porter's done a study of what happens to homeowners in bankruptcy who are trying to stay in their homes. Professor Porter, good to have you with us.
Thank you.
You did some research into Chapter 13 bankruptcies. What exactly did you find?
What I found is that bankruptcy, which we conceive of as a refuge for homeowners in trouble, is actually the locus of significant misbehavior by mortgage companies. Instead of helping people save their homes in bankruptcy, some lenders are actually abusing the bankruptcy process to harm consumers and threaten their chance to save their houses.
Misbehavior sounds kind of like a law professor word. What does that mean in actual practice?
Bankruptcy law has a carefully crafted set of rules to ensure that consumers and companies, their creditors, exchange information so that only the accurate and legal amount of the debt is paid. In more than one half of the loans that I studied, the mortgage company didn't follow the rules. They didn't attach the required documentation to show the amount of the debt that was owed and document that that was correct. And in a lot of instances, they tacked on fees that are not permissible or may, in fact, not be permissible, but there was so little information provided, nobody could determine that.
What kinds of fees are we talking about?
Well, some of the examples that were just really, really common were things like a $50 fax fee. There's even an email fee. In some instances, I saw very large fees, $5,000, $8,000. The only description given was other.
Is it illegal to charge somebody $50 to send a fax?
It's not been ruled illegal in any kind of national, consistent basis. I think those charges could quite easily be challenged as being unreasonable or even unconscionable under existing law.
Who's supposed to be keeping an eye on loan servicing companies and loan originators? I mean, aren't there regulators who are supposed to do this?
This is one of the problems. There's a real regulatory black hole here. In theory, the agency in charge of this would be HUD. Housing and Urban Development. And their mortgage servicers are actually their number one area of complaint that they receive. But so far, HUD has taken the attitude that this is not really an area of major policy focus for them. And part of the lesson, I think, of my study is that that needs to change. People don't just lose their houses because they get into bad loans. They lose their houses because they can't get out of bad loans. They can't get the company to take their payments. They can't understand what they're being charged. They can't get a real human on the phone to help them work things out when they do get into trouble.
So what are consumers supposed to do? I mean, if you're worried about losing your house, the last thing really you want to do is sit down and plow through this big, thick document you get from your bank. What are you supposed to do about it?
I think the best advice for consumers is to keep the best records that they can, to document every phone call or letter that they send to their mortgage servicer, and to ask their company for a detailed loan history showing all of the charges that the company's trying to collect from them.
Catherine Porter at the University of Iowa School of Law. Professor, thanks for your time.
Thank you.
Coming up, the private sector helps make military base housing less basic.
When my husband's not here, I'm able to call the men at on the maintenance team, and they just are able to assess me, and I almost feel like I am a homeowner.
But first, let's do the numbers. Stocks bounced back from early losses today to close higher on Wall Street. The Dow Industrials climbed 0.8%, 117 points to close at 13,660. The Nasdaq shot up more than 1% or 30 points to close at 2825. The S&P 500 rose 1.1%, 16 points to end the day at 1519. ExxonMobil gushed up more than 3% as oil prices topped $97 a barrel, as we mentioned. 97.07, I think, was the high. Agro giant Archer Daniels Midland sowed a 6.78% gain after a volatile commodities market helped its quarterly profits. Shares in Nortel Networks rang up more than a 17% gain. The telecom equipment manufacturer turned a prior year loss into a healthy net income. Markets overseas were mixed. Back home, bond prices rose. The yield on the 10-year T-note fell to 4.37%. And you're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by A.G. Edwards, caring for nest eggs for more than 120 years, with a commitment to provide objective financial advice. And by the American Public Transportation Association, committed to an energy-independent America by increased use of public transportation at publictransportation.org. Science and technology reports are supported by Boston Scientific, committed to delivering what's next in medical technology to help clinicians improve and extend lives. BostonScientific.com. These days, it seems that everyone is talking about sustainability. Want to know how you fit in? A new online game from American Public Media can help you find out what the world might look like if everyone lived, or at least consumed, like you. Go to our website, marketplace.org, and click on Consumer Consequences.
Here's a look at events coming up Wednesday, November 7th. Former Illinois Governor George Ryan is ordered to begin serving a 6-year prison sentence for bribery and corruption. The European Union reviews Turkey's bid for membership. And on this day in 1910, an aviator for the Wright Company transported the first air freight shipment. The goods traveled 70 miles from Dayton, Ohio to Columbus. The cargo, 2 bolts of silk. I'm Jennifer Collins.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdal. So far in Pakistan, it's been the lawyers who've been leading the opposition to the state of emergency that was declared over the weekend. But business owners might have been a more effective choice because they at least speak the same economic language as many army officers. Some estimates are that Pakistan's army controls businesses worth as much as $40 billion, maybe 10 or 15% of the whole economy. The RAND Corporation's Seth Jones says the army occupies a unique spot in Pakistan society, and it has for decades.
The Pakistani army has a role in many ways, and that is it's not just involved in defense, but it also has quite a complex conglomerate. You know, most of these small-scale and large-scale corporate enterprises range the gamut from private security firms and bakeries, farms, schools, to insurance companies, cement and cereal manufacturing plants.
Military organizations, when you rise to the top, you've demonstrated some organizational skill, but really, what do Pakistan's generals know about running businesses?
Well, I'm not sure they know an extraordinary amount, although most of these business ventures really began in the 1950s. So over the years, they have built a pretty serious economic enterprise system within Pakistan. So I suspect there has been learning over the decades, but I think most of these military officials involved are military officers first and businessmen and entrepreneurs second.
Is this all above board? Does everybody know about this?
Well, I think most people, both in Pakistan and internationally, do understand to some degree that the Pakistani military is involved, but the specifics are very secretive.
Where do the profits go that these enterprises generate?
It's my understanding that the profits actually go to the Ministry of Defense and the individuals involved in it. I don't think there's a really good, reliable estimate of how much we're talking about, but it's in the billions of dollars.
So when a company goes out and puts a want ad in the paper and it says, I need, you know, bakers for my new bakery shop that I'm going to open up in Rawalpindi, does it say, you know, the Pakistani army is hiring today or something like that?
I would guess in most cases it probably does not, although with some of the social welfare organizations that are run by the Ministry of Defense, they do have advertisements. But I think, you know, there is an effort to conceal much of this activity.
So over the past 5 or 6 years, Pakistan has gotten about $10 billion, I guess, plus or minus from the United States. What has it done with that money?
Well, the Pakistani military in general has increased its competence primarily in conventional weapons and conventional combat capability. It has deployed some forces to the federally administered tribal areas to conduct very limited operations against al-Qaeda and other militants. But for the most part, a lot of this funding is and equipment is geared towards what could be considered combating the Indians.
So not, strictly speaking, counterterrorism?
So not strictly counterterrorism, no, by no means.
The money that the Bush administration has sent to Pakistan aside, the Pakistani economy in and of itself is really doing pretty well, isn't it?
Yeah, the economy is doing fairly well. It will be interesting to see with the rioting in the streets how this will impact general business, but the economy has done fairly well.
Do you suppose the military stands to lose any money if this state of emergency goes on too long?
If demonstrations persist, levels of violence increase, you could see an impact on the general state of the economy. And I suspect if the economy begins to suffer significantly in Pakistan, the military, which again is deeply involved in a variety of different businesses, will probably suffer with it.
Seth Jones, a South Asia analyst at the RAND Corporation in Washington. Mr. Jones, thanks for your time.
Thank you very much.
Here's a housing story that doesn't have the words subprime or slump in it. Also, it's a story about Pentagon contracting that doesn't involve fraud, waste, or abuse. It's about government privatization that doesn't mention Blackwater or Halliburton. The Pentagon has awarded $20 billion worth of construction contracts to fix on-base housing for its soldiers. And business is booming. From North Carolina Public Radio, Dave DeWitt has more.
Colonel David Fox runs Fort Bragg as garrison commander. He's been in the Army 27 years. And remembers every tiny apartment he and his family of four ever had to cram into.
One of the first houses we ever moved in had linoleum tile all the way through it. You'd stand out on the front street and you could see that the roof line sagged. It was infested with termites.
Those days and those houses are slowly on their way out. On bases across the country, private construction companies are building, renovating, and maintaining nearly 200,000 homes. That's upgrading the quality of military life dramatically. Nowhere is that more apparent than at the Linden Oaks development at Fort Bragg. It's a Halloween party. Tiny ninjas, sorcerers, and princesses are playing tag inside the development's ample clubhouse gym. Linden Oaks could be any development in any upper-middle-class American suburb. That it's inside Fort Bragg is a sign of how far base housing has come. Private First Class Nathaniel Williams lives about a quarter mile away from the clubhouse in a 1,900-square-foot townhouse with his wife Tara and their three kids. He remembers the old days.
You know, when I decided to come into the Army, moving from my own home to an apartment kind of left a really bad taste in my mouth because, like, we have all this furniture, we have all these clothes, we have all these people. You know, we're a family of five and we're right on top of each other.
That disappointment went away when the family moved to Linden Oaks. And so did some of the worry that comes when he's gone for long stretches. simple tasks can become challenges for those left behind, like cleaning a gutter or replacing a broken light fixture. When the Army was in charge, it was more likely to give a spouse a ticket for an unmowed lawn than to help out. Tara Williams says privatization has changed that.
When my husband's not here, I'm able to call the men at on the maintenance team, and they just are able to assist me, and I almost feel like I am a homeowner.
The military likes to hear that. Fort Bragg Garrison Commander David Fox.
5 years ago, 6 years ago, the garrison commanders dealt with housing. That was the number one issue. That was the problem. I can't get something fixed. The house is in poor condition. Now I don't hear housing problems.
John Pisern likes to hear that, too. The CEO of Pisern Military Housing won the contract to build and renovate homes at Fort Bragg and four other military bases. 5 years ago, he gambled on this business. It looked stable, but his investors didn't think it had the potential for a big payday, the kind that developers were seeing in the frothy housing market then. Now that gamble looks pretty good.
I remember saying to one of my board of advisors about 5 years ago, we first got in this business, you know, had a full-blown business plan, and he turned to me and he said, but what happens if the Army goes away? And I said, I don't mean to be glib, but if the Army goes away, we all have much bigger problems than a business plan.
That business plan is simple. Pisern leases military land for $1 a year, builds the houses, and collects the soldiers' housing allowances. PFC Williams, for example, pays rent of $1,100 a month. The contract between the Army and the developer runs for 50 years, with an option for an additional 25. Just a few years into the deal, the Army is so thrilled with the arrangement that recruiters are using the new homes as a reenlistment incentive. In Fayetteville, North Carolina, I'm Dave DeWitt for Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by U.S. Trust, Bank of America Private Wealth Management, committed to understanding the values that truly matter to clients and offering a personal approach to managing their wealth. By Duke University's Fuqua School of Business Executive MBA programs, where working professionals earn Duke MBAs from locations around the world, online at DukeExecutiveMBA.com. And by Putnam Investments, where a diversified mix of international investments can strengthen your portfolio. Putnam Investments, a prudent approach to investing. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication.
This final note may be a little something to make the consumer in you ashamed of yourself. A couple of weeks ago, you might remember the band Radiohead when, against common convention, it decided to let its fans decide how much to pay to download its new album. Well, might not have been such a good move after all. More than half of the people who downloaded In Rainbows during a four-week period back in October decided it was worth nothing. Nada, zip, zero, not a dime. The 38% that did pay forked over an average of $6. That's from an online study by Comscore. A publicist said the band had no comments on getting stiffed. And that is Marketplace from American Public Media. Today, the Dow picked up 117 points, 0.8%. The Nasdaq bumped up 30 points, just over 1%. The S&P 500 added 16 points, 0.1%. Thanks today to Renita Jablonski and Miguel Macias on our Morning Report crew. The Marketplace Morning Report is produced by John Buckley. Our executive producer is J.J. Yore. Coming up next time on this program, for reservists back from Iraq, just getting a job can be the biggest battle.
She said, it's the fact that military people have to be told when to tie their boots. And I laughed, and I said, I was a Lance Corporal with three guys under me, and I was the one making all the decisions.
I'm Kai Rizdahl. Hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.